Hello, it's Tuesday, 28th of September. I'm Gary Bauman from Check in Asia. On this week's show, Hannah Pearson from Per Anderson and I will bookend our recent 2021 The Year So Far in ASEAN series by assessing 10 vital learnings from the year so far. So let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. So, as our regular listeners will know, we just rounded out our 10-part 2021 The Year So Far in ASEAN series. We kicked off the series with an ASEAN Year So Far overview back in July, and we also produced a Year So Far in Statistics show. Over the past 2 months, we spoke to local analysts in 8 countries of the region: Singapore, Vietnam, Laos, Indonesia, the Philippines, Malaysia, Cambodia, and Thailand. And a big thank you to all of our 8 guests. We really enjoyed all of your insider knowledge and insights, and it seems so did our listeners. Each of the 8 interviews has been really well received, both in ASEAN and worldwide.
Yep, absolutely have. So now, as we prepare to enter the fourth quarter of 2021, Hannah, can you believe that? We've bashed our heads together to create a list of 10 top talking points from the year that so far hasn't really got going, but perhaps a rush of travel activity awaits us just around the corner. So Hannah, let's get cracking. And the first of our 10 picks is one of yours. So tell us more.
Yeah, I mean, the first pick really is 2021 is shaping up to be much worse than 2020 for tourism businesses. I mean, in 2020, yes, we had the pandemic, but we did have those few months at the beginning of the year where we still had fairly normal international arrivals and domestic travel kind of went on last year. That's completely changed this year. The Delta variant has thrown all of that up in the air, and many markets which saw very strong domestic travel last year, like Vietnam, like Indonesia, have just not had those same opportunities this year. A lot of interstate, interprovincial travel has been banned, particularly over key festival periods as well. And that has just meant that local tourism businesses have had really little to zero income for the majority of the year. And, you know, looking towards the end of the year, yes, governments are kind of talking about reopening tourism internationally, but is that going to happen? We'll see.
Looking back on our 2021, The Year So Far in ASEAN series, pretty much everybody that we spoke to said that at the turn of the year, you know, there was this sense of a degree of optimism. It was cautious optimism, of course, that vaccines would roll out relatively quickly, and that there would be, at least as you said, domestic tourism would probably flourish this year. Perhaps international tourism would take a lot longer, and maybe it wouldn't have really started to kick on until perhaps the final quarter anyway. But domestic tourism really was seen as something that would support the industry and would enable travellers to keep travelling and keep that confidence up. That simply hasn't happened. We know the reasons, as you said, were the Delta variant just changed absolutely everything. The experiences in India, I think, really scared all of the ASEAN governments. There were real fears that healthcare systems could collapse in the same way that it did in parts of India. As we've noted throughout the series, countries in the region that seemed relatively or even totally COVID safe last year and even at the beginning of this year got hit pretty badly. So the whole region has suffered. There's no such thing as zero COVID anymore. And if you look at the 10 countries in aggregation across the year, like you say, Hannah, it's been worse than 2020. And the signs are that, you know, it's now going to be all about vaccines going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. So that probably brings you to our second point, which was one of your picks, Gary. And I really loved this when we were discussing what our top 10 talking points should be, which is governments being in control of travel is a disaster.
Yeah, well, where do I start? I mean, I have said this a few times on different podcasts over the year, but it's a simple fact. I think as we were going into this pandemic, what, a year and a half ago, it seems like much longer than that, it was pretty clear that most governments in the region didn't understand their visitor economies. They did, not just the tourism sector, but the whole mix: education, business travel, MICE, visit family and friends, all of the elements that come together. The government simply didn't understand it. They understood the financial value, but they didn't really understand the intricacies. And that has played out. Now, if we go back 18 months, the reason that governments shut down their borders, which was valid, I guess, in most countries around the world did that, that's not just in our region, that was because it was seen that human mobility, international travel, was the primary vector of transmission. The problem with that is that we've gone through, 15 months of just case counting. And all of a sudden, governments seem to have changed their policy, but they haven't really planned ahead. They haven't really looked at what would happen next. We've said that closing borders is obviously much easier than reopening them. That's a given. We have to understand that. And governments are tasked with protecting the health and the livelihood of their populations. Totally understand that as well. But the lack of planning, I think, going forward has been almost non-existent in some countries. We've ended up with these kind of hybrid tourism reopening plans and policies which haven't worked, and everybody else seems to be following along with Phuket Sandbox or something similar to that. And it's a lot of recycled thinking. Unfortunately, I guess one of the key problems is that tourism and travel have become more political than ever. You know, because of the safety aspect, because of the health aspect, these have become cabinet level issues, which travel and tourism wasn't before. You know, there are so many different ministries across a government have their own input into what happens next. And that probably won't go away. You know, this is something we're going to have to live with into the next year and probably years in future, that governments have a much stronger hold on the way that tourism works. And that really strangles the public sector. And where we are right now, it's looking pretty grim, because all we hear from pretty much most governments in the region is something very similar.
It is, and not only similar, but somehow each government department, like you said, everybody has got a finger in the tourism pie. And so, especially the last month or so, we have seen so many miscommunications, so many mixed messages. Finance Ministry says one thing, the National Tourism Board says another thing, the Ministry of Tourism says another thing, Ministry of Foreign Affairs says a different thing. And it's so difficult for tourism stakeholders to keep track of what's accurate, what's up to date. It's really a minefield. I mean, how do you prepare your business? How do you know when it's time to get employees back? You've just got no idea for most of these countries. And of course, like you say, you know, it's understandable, things are changing. It's a very dynamic situation. But for many, many industries, countries in the region, they just need some kind of clarity, some kind of, okay, at this stage, we will reopen interstate travel. At this stage, when we hit this, we will reopen international travel. At least some kind of landmark, because otherwise you're just flying completely blind.
Indecision, lack of planning, and as you say, probably above all else, a lack of transparency about how these things are actually working, what's going on behind the scenes. Again, probably a lack of coordination with the private sector, with the travel industry itself. You know, all of these things are creating issues that, you know, could be more easily ironed out. But that brings us into point three quite nicely, Hannah, because this is one of your picks. And while governments are going their own, all 10 governments in the region are going their own way, and they have right from the beginning in terms of how they control and mitigate COVID-19 and how they're looking to reopen, we haven't seen any ASEAN cooperation. And right now, it just seems a bit like a pipe dream.
It is, isn't it? You know, I checked when they started to talk about this ASEAN travel corridor, and that was last November, right? That's 10 months ago that ASEAN started to talk about, oh, maybe let's have this travel corridor. And every time they have a big ASEAN meeting, it always comes up. They're always saying, yes, we need to do this. We need to do mutual recognition of each other's vaccination certificates. And nothing ever comes of it. Countries like Thailand now, they're not really looking at the short-haul markets. I think there was an article just yesterday from the TAT saying they're starting to look at Malaysia and Indonesia. They've seen interest from Malaysia and Indonesia to travel to Thailand. But short-haul markets are not the focus for countries like Thailand right now for international reopening. They're looking at mid-haul markets. They're looking at long-haul markets like Europe, like the US. Because, you know, as we keep saying, the region is just at so many different speeds in terms of COVID response. And that in itself is probably a failure of ASEAN as well, to not see the bigger picture and to realize that when one country has a spike, guess what? That's going to affect the other neighboring countries, because there are so many migrant workers between them all.
100% with everything that you said there, that the lack of regional cooperation is actually hurting individual countries as well. A story published in the Straits Times yesterday in Singapore, where Singapore's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Vivian Balakrishnan, said exactly what you've just said. For a start, we've got to settle mutual recognition of health certificates, vaccine certificates. That's, in a sense, making sure our digital systems, our ability to verify records are in place. Now, this is 18 months in. Either he's being very diplomatic in that, and there is work being done on this, but, you know, there hasn't been any agreement, or they're moving forward behind the scenes, he doesn't want to say too much, or simply it hasn't happened. I don't know what it is, because we're not really we'll come to the media in a moment. We don't really have an investigative media that's actually finding out. But, you know, if that's a statement 18 months in, you'd have to wonder what is the purpose of ASEAN right now? Because it's failed. I think you said this before, Hannah. In recent months, it's failed on Myanmar. It's failed on COVID-19. It's failed on reopening. What is it actually delivering for the region? Could in future we see a much more fragmented ASEAN in place?
Yeah, precisely. So let's talk about one of ASEAN's big neighbours, big brothers, Gary, and this is one of your areas of special interest, really. You think Southeast Asian tourism players are directionless without Chinese tourists. Tell us more.
Yeah, I do. I think they've become very directionless over the last year and a half because it's by far the biggest market for the whole region. If you go back to 2019, China supplied 32.3 million visitors to the region. That's almost a quarter of total visitors into the region. There were 143.5 million visitors into and around ASEAN in 2019. Only two countries actually provided more than 10 million visitors during that year, Singapore and Korea. So China was way out in front. But I think even in 2019, in some countries, the growth of Chinese visitor arrivals was slowing slightly. But I think it was also masked the fact that most tourism boards really didn't understand how to market to China very well. I would exempt Singapore from that because I think they've been excellent. They worked really hard to move outside of the primary cities into secondary and tertiary cities. They've been very successful with that. And they've also done the same in India. I think Singapore's marketing into both those markets is exemplary. Most other countries in the region, you know, a lot of the marketing for many countries was done by AirAsia or the airlines that were bringing in plane loads of tourists from China. The Chinese airlines also managed to get a lot of routes into the region. But the tourism board marketing was pretty poor. And then when that market disappeared, we've seen over the last year and a half, you know, we hear all this talk about, you know, virtual tours and live streaming as a way to bring back Chinese travelers, but no one's really looking, from what I'm seeing or what I'm hearing, no one in tourism boards across this region is really looking at how Chinese consumers are changing, how Chinese domestic travelers have changed. You know, consumers and travelers in all countries of Asia Pacific have changed a great deal over the last 18 months through circumstances, through the healthcare crisis, and through the opportunities that have been limited during that time. The way people are buying, the way people are traveling, the way they're perusing, the way they're booking is very, very different to it was before. So I think that the whole region really needs to rethink how it will approach China. We don't yet know when Chinese travelers will come back into the region, but, you know, the marketing will certainly have to be better. And you can't just rely on that big number, 32.3 million coming back straight away, because it won't happen. So there's going to be a tough fight to bring Chinese travelers back into markets because of their proven spending power. But I really think the tourism boards and the travel industry itself will really have to up its game, because I think it'll be a much tougher sell than it was 2 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you've said it all on China. So let's move on. My next pick is really that vaccines have not been the save-all that the tourism industry thought that they would be. So this time last year, I think we were probably talking about vaccines and they were kind of on the horizon. They had not yet been approved, I don't think, in September last year. Well, perhaps they have been in America, but they were kind of getting there. That's what everybody was gearing up towards. Everybody was thinking, right, 2021 is going to be much better. We're going to have these vaccines. We're going to roll them out really fast. And do you know what? I don't think they thought much beyond that. Like you were just saying, you know, governments have not really looked into this mutual recognition of vaccine certificates. Countries like the Philippines have only just launched a system where the local government units can upload Filipinos' vaccination status so that they can have some kind of digital certificate that's recognised nationwide. It really seems that a lot of governments didn't get much further than thinking, oh, let's procure some vaccines, if they even thought that. And that's it. And now they're at this point where they're having to still deal with, okay, how can we make sure that we can recognise each other's vaccine certificates? As well as in some countries like Vietnam, how can we still procure the vaccines? Which just seems kind of almost ludicrous at this point that we can be at the end of Q3 in 2021 and countries here are still trying to wrap their head around how to do a mass vaccination rollout.
Going back to our point one, the Delta variant definitely changed everything because it really upped the urgency for procuring vaccines. I think some countries ordered late and they arrived late. Some countries were relying partially, particularly at the beginning, on COVAX or even direct donor vaccines from China, from Russia, from the US, or from wherever. But that need to bring in big volumes each on each occasion and cut out this irregular supply, that was really changed by both the Delta variant and also the fact, as you said, Hannah, a year ago, you know, some countries in the region weren't really expecting to require that many vaccines initially because they were relatively COVID safe. You could argue that they were a little bit complacent. I think probably New Zealand would be in the same boat there, is that they just didn't order quickly enough. And that's come home to roost. But the problem with that is it doesn't just affect one single country, it affects the whole region. And you know, you keep hearing this argument that everybody's in it together. But I think in Southeast Asia, that's absolutely true. Is that, you know, it's very, very difficult for any country to come out of this alone because ASEAN travel is so important, but also each country is looking at each other in terms of how it's going to reopen to the rest of the world. And vaccines are just an intrinsic part of that. You mentioned there that, you know, different countries have also been mixing and matching whatever they can get. I think Vietnam currently has 8 vaccines that it's using. So actually verifying that for other countries and also for itself is going to be a hell of a task.
Yeah, exactly. There's so many different complications with it. Like you said, the vaccine mixing or the interval dosing even. It's just become a bit of a minefield, I think. And it's no wonder with all of these different complications that are going on that there hasn't been this kind of mutual recognition of vaccination certificates. But like you said, Gary, they are really intrinsic to reopening. Countries like Thailand this week they really set this bar at 70% have to be vaccinated for different regions to reopen, like Bangkok. The same with Phukok also has to hit a certain percentage. I think Indonesia too, to reopen. They're really linked. And then, of course, we have the whole dilemma. And we discussed this, and I think you did this pretty well. Like, I think you call it ghettoization of travel when you're talking about Phuket, Gary. Are you prioritizing tourism places for vaccines? Are you prioritizing places that have higher rates of COVID for vaccines? And that's a struggle that a lot of governments are coming up against in the region as well. How do you then go about rolling out the vaccine in a fair way, but at the same time trying to support the tourism industry? It's tricky.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, one of the ways that Malaysia has probably benefited for this, I think, is the fact that it doesn't have as big a population as some of the other countries in the region, 32.7 million. It's moved really quickly in the last 3 or 4 months with its vaccine rollout. You know, it just doesn't have, you know, hitting that 70, 80, 90% of the adult population threshold is much easier when you only have a much smaller population. Doing that with a population of 272 million in Indonesia or around about 100 million just under in Vietnam is a huge undertaking. So let's move on to point 6, Hannah, because this really sets up, which I think is the meat and drink of what we're going to talk about. And this is your point. So number 6, you've said, Hannah, that reopening may come down to 2 models, the Phuket sandbox style or the Singapore vaccinated travel lane style. Tell us more.
We were saying earlier in the episode, loads of countries now within Southeast Asia are all looking at the Phuket sandbox. Every week you can kind of count another country that says we're going to emulate the Phuket sandbox. So Indonesia has said that about Bali now. Malaysia has said that about Langkawi. Last week the Philippines said that they were also very closely watching the Phuket sandbox in terms of international reopening. But of course the irony there is that the Phuket tourism stakeholders themselves actually want to change it because they don't think that it has been particularly successful. Yes, they have seen tourists visiting, but definitely not in the volumes that they expected them to at the beginning of the period when it reopened. So you've got that model on the one hand, which is allowing people from specific countries, and there's about 60 countries on the list now, I think, that the TAT and Thailand permit to fly into Thailand, but you're limited to the places that you can visit, versus Singapore's vaccinated travel lane, which is very much about opening unilaterally, but only to certain destinations. But then, of course, they can visit the whole country. So Singapore's vaccinated travel lanes, the government last week said that they have been pretty successful. There's only been one COVID positive case out of 900 arrivals so far, but it's pretty limited. You know, it's only Singapore to Germany. It's still got very hefty RT-PCR tests involved. Really, I think for many people to want to use this, you're going to really have to have a reason. And according to Forward Keys data, it seems a lot more interest from Singapore travelling to Germany than from Germany travelling to Singapore. So you do need that kind of reciprocal leisure travel, which again, Phuket Sandbox doesn't really have either. That's completely leisure. Complete focus is on inbound rather than, you know, letting Phuket residents travel to wherever for holidays. So although there are other models in the world, of course, for reopening, you know, some countries have just thrown open the borders, test negative, that's good enough. Some countries are opening to fully vaccinated tourists, doesn't matter where you're from. In Southeast Asia, it really seems to be coming down to a choice between those two models, Phuket Sandbox or vaccinated travelling.
Which is, on the face of it, or even digging even deeper, absolutely mystifying. I think the only real reason that you can understand why anybody would want to open up a Phuket Sandbox style reopening is risk limitation and not wanting to put your head above the parapet. I think everybody who understands tourism, even the tourism industry in Thailand, knows that it has failed. It hasn't been successful. In 3 months, it's about 33,000 visitors. A rough estimate is about 50% of those are actually Thai citizens or Thai or foreign residents living in Thailand, finding a route back into Thailand that doesn't involve a hard quarantine in Bangkok. It hasn't worked. It simply hasn't worked. So why would other countries replicate that? I think countries are fearful of doing something different, are fearful of getting it wrong. It's quite a simple model to replicate in the fact that you just, as you said earlier, Hannah, you kind of ghettoize travel, you put it into specific areas, you vaccinate those areas, or in some cases, for Kwok's example, you haven't even vaccinated, so you have to delay the reopening. But it's just a model of recycled thinking. It's nothing is new there. I mean, really what the region needs is somebody to take a lead and just be more liberal and just to reopen, you know, and actually just allow your own vaccinated travelers to go overseas and vaccinated travelers from selected countries or from a broader swathe to come into the country. And you have to make sure, as Malaysia has at the moment, that you have a very high percentage of your own population vaccinated. If you can hit 90%, then you really can start to open up, not just through this bubble or sandbox model. I think it's going to need an external stimulus. I think it's going to need a country in the region that is prepared to take a bigger stance on this. Australia may be one of those. China, perhaps, but it's not looking as though they're going to travel into the region, except into maybe selected countries like Cambodia or Laos for the foreseeable future. Maybe Japan, maybe South Korea, but I just don't see it happening within Southeast Asia because everybody is thinking the same. Everybody is fearful of doing anything different. And as you say, Hannah, it's all really focused on inbound travel at the moment, and travel needs to be two-way. Until you've got that moving and you've got that inbound, outbound flow, it's difficult for airlines, it's difficult for travel agents, and you're not really moving forward at all. You're simply just taking incremental steps that just don't really lead anywhere.
Yeah. I mean, so that leads quite neatly to your next point, Gary, which was that pent-up demand is probable, but not guaranteed.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I think, you know, what we're seeing across the region, domestic travel, is that people are willing to travel domestically. Although I was up in Langkawi, the reopening of Langkawi last week, I was there this weekend here in Malaysia. There's only one destination that's open at the moment in Malaysia, and that's after 8 months. And although there are travelers going to Langkawi, definitely for sure, it's slow. It's not as fast as expected. But that will build over time. You've got to rebuild confidence, and domestic travel is a good way of doing that. But, you know, traveling overseas again is much different to traveling domestically. And although we hear these terms, pent-up demand, and we hear revenge travel, these aren't guaranteed by any means. You know, even if you're just using traveler sentiment surveys to generate this, it's easy to say that I would like to travel when the opportunity comes again, but actually doing that to a country that is going to require you to have, well, maybe a smaller quarantine, loads of PCR tests, maybe track and trace you the whole of your trip, that's a different entity. And as we've seen from South Koreans this summer, you know, they probably can't come into Southeast Asia anyway, but their choice was Europe, because simply it's much easier to travel in Europe. The restrictions aren't there. You can fly into Europe. You don't have really any limits on your freedoms to travel. And it's just much easier. And I think until Southeast Asia grasps this fact that just traveling in and out to restricted zones, ghettoized areas, it isn't what the market's going to want going forward. And until it really thinks differently about travel, and we don't really know what Southeast Asian travelers themselves will want when they go out. Well, you know, it's highly likely that Australia, New Zealand, Europe, US, these kind of destinations might be more popular than regional destinations. I think the big driver will be visit family and friends. That will be a big key driver initially. But, you know, there's certainly no guarantee that even initial spikes in international travel will be sustained over a whole year period.
Yes, exactly. And Nick Ray, actually, from who we interviewed him a few months ago about Cambodia, but he was in the press just last week because Cambodian tourism trade held a press conference exactly saying that to the Cambodian government. Look, you've got this opportunity now to reopen, but tourists don't want all of these restrictions and everything else. They've got the choice. They can go to a destination that's really easy. They don't have to jump through hoops. And that's what it's going to be down to. And if it makes it too difficult to get in, Southeast Asia is going to lose out.
Yeah, totally agree. So let's move on to something I just touched upon there, but is vitally important. And to be fair to you, honey, you've been talking about this right from the beginning. And that's overlooking domestic markets is a long-term mistake. Now, this is something that happened before the pandemic. It's become much more in focus during the pandemic. But moving ahead, you know, we're seeing this focus towards inbound. Do you think that the governments in the region are going to overlook domestic markets as we move forward?
Yeah, that's my big fear, really, I think. Because it's more exciting, isn't it? They're, like you said, before the pandemic, there was always this focus on inbound travel. Domestic travel was something of an afterthought, despite the fact that in many countries, like Indonesia, for example, domestic travel actually earns more than inbound travel. But still, there's always this focus in terms of marketing, in terms of coming up with campaigns, that's always focusing on the inbound market. And there was really a lack of understanding about what domestic tourists wanted. And of course, we had to see this whole shift in terms of tourism operators at the beginning of 2020, when they realized that they had to start catering for the domestic market rather than the inbound market. But my fear still is, you know, now that governments can see that the end, kind of the end, it's a little pinprick of light at the end of the tunnel, perhaps, for international travel, inbound travel, you know, they're going to focus on that. They're going to grab hold of that. Whereas domestic travel, which is what's going to sustain the tourism industry, but probably the next year or so until inbound travel really picks up to those same levels that we have seen, or even just half of the levels that we've seen. You know, if they don't start focusing on that, if they don't start supporting the domestic tourism industry with subsidies, with grants, just with marketing campaigns, a lot of tourism businesses are going to close shop before the international tourists manage to get in.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, which kind of leads a little bit into our point nine. We can talk about them both together, because point nine is that outbound travel is currently of little importance to governments. We've touched on that, very much a focus on inbound at the moment. We know over the last decade, you know, inbound travel for most governments, most tourism boards was the money earner, but it was also really the way to attract foreign investment. But domestic markets, you know, as we've been hit very hard. This is the biggest disruption in the travel industry, in most business sectors, in our lifetime. And things aren't going to go back to normal straight away. They're going to take time. The road back to recovery in most business sectors can be long and quite tough. And you've got to find ways to rebuild confidence. And domestic tourism is a great way to do that. Gradually, people can start feeling comfortable with traveling, whether that's taking a driving trip, you know, whether that's taking a boat, whether that's taking a plane, just become used to traveling again as part of a lifestyle. Because outbound travel is going to be, you know, a big challenge for many people. But the way that governments are looking at this only really as an inbound economy, not looking at domestic, as you said, Hannah, the new experiences that domestic travelers have created for themselves actually during this pandemic and how that can play into inbound travel. Outbound travel really is only really focused on, well, it doesn't seem to have any focus at all, apart from, as you mentioned, Singapore there with its vaccinated travel lanes. Malaysia is making some moves. You know, it's talking about perhaps allowing Malaysians to travel overseas with a limited quarantine upon return, a home quarantine. You know, maybe Malaysia might be one of the markets to watch, but I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. You know, travel and tourism, visitor economies of all kinds have always been, should be three-way, and that's inbound, outbound, and domestic. And at the moment, the whole equation has just shifted so far in favor of inbound travel that recreating that balance again at the moment looks really difficult.
Yeah, and in terms of financial assistance, outbound travel agents or tourism companies in general, which are focused on outbound, have suffered so badly. You know, not only have they been largely ignored, a lot of the financial subsidies were perhaps not available to them. And then they've had to pivot their entire business model to build up a knowledge of the inbound market, to build up this knowledge of domestic travellers, and they still don't have any indication of when borders might open. You know, they've been hanging on. A lot of them are in hibernation now, just wondering, is it worth carrying on, or should I just shut up shop and change industry?
There are going to be huge numbers of businesses aren't going to make it through to 2022, and the bookings market is certainly one of those. There's going to be huge consolidation, particularly online. But domestic markets just mean so much more. I think there is the financial aspect, there is the business sector, there's the livelihood aspect, but I think there's just also this sort of vibrancy in the national economy and in the national feel-good factor as well, that if people are traveling around the country, they're spending more, they feel more confident, they meet up with friends, they meet up with family. There is just an element of rebuilding nationhood after such a difficult period, now for everybody in all countries around the world, and having that feeling come back that life is going back to somewhere near what it used to be is really important. Domestic tourism can play such an important role in that.
It does. So let's move to our last point then. And this was quite passionately advocated for really in our interview with Vincent Vijayvadakkan a couple of weeks ago. And that's that media reporting of travel during the pandemic is very much clickbait driven. Now, Gary, you said earlier that the Southeast Asian media here is not really an investigative media. And I think never have we seen that more. When we see all of these reports of what government spokespersons are saying and then being reported as true, as in these are facts and Bali is going to reopen in July or Bangkok is going to reopen in September. There's none of the asterisks, terms and conditions apply. This may happen. This might not happen. This is subject to approval. And these stories just get blown out of proportion, don't they?
Yeah, they do. And I have to say that it's not just the local media that's at fault at this. There was a case a couple of weeks ago, one of the wires reported a press conference from the minister who's in charge of coordinating the COVID recovery in Indonesia. He made a statement at a press conference that Bali may open in October or November. Now, we knew this. This was nothing new. This wasn't a statement out of the ordinary, and it didn't actually create a story. May open in October or November. There's nothing there. That's not really a story to report. Yet that got picked up by media around the world. I think it's because everybody wants good news right now. And media are just picking up on stories that are good news travel stories. And if you've got Bali in the name, you know, that tends to have this resonance or rock star resonance that travelers kind of acquired over the last 18 months. You know, it's become a front page issue where it wasn't before. And most of that is simply because of scarcity, because there isn't much travel happening. But media has to be much more responsible. As we move into a new era, whatever that era may be, you know, we can't have this continued reporting of statements and pronouncements as fact. You know, they have to be much better fact check. They have to be follow-up questions. There has to be, if you're not going to open in October or November, why have you got this choice on the table? That's an eight or nine week period. You know, what is it that would allow you to open in October? What would allow you to open in November? But none of that happens. And so all we end up really with is just a lot of clickbait stories that actually don't help the travel industry. They don't help them plan. In fact, they're very frustrating for the travel industry because you keep reading the same thing said by the same people. And they certainly don't help travelers, and they don't really help governments themselves. It ends up just going very, very circular and going nowhere. And I think, you know, the Phuket Sandbox, I have to say, is the biggest at fault for this, because over a year now, I guess, since they've been talking about Phuket, since the special tourist visa, we've just had pumped out statements so regularly, just saying stuff that gets reported as fact. Vincent said this very accurately, and it's taking us nowhere. And you know, this is everything we've said pretty much over the last 10 points that we've made, is at the moment, if you look at the year so far, it's taken us nowhere because we've just been wasting time with stuff that's pretty irrelevant when the real, real detail-driven stuff that needs to be done. Maybe it's being done behind the scenes, but we're not getting that transparency. And I think that's something that we'll probably reflect on in the years to come and think, well, perhaps it didn't need to be this way.
100%. I think I can't say it any better. But yeah, I am personally fed up of reading all of these conflicting stories on a daily basis. You know, I was joking to Gary the other week that I put together my weekly report on impact of COVID-19 on Southeast Asia. And I only ever write up Thailand on the last day that I send out this report, because I know if I started writing it up on Monday, it would be completely changed by Sunday.
And you've been doing that for 18 months, Hannah, so I have huge empathy with the amount of media stories that you've actually filed through, because you really do have to sift it out. And it's quite frustrating that you just tend to see the same quotes by the same people saying the same things over and over again. They just kind of get updated and you just kind of feel. And if I was a minister, I just wouldn't want to be reading out stuff that's on my press release and just, you know, leaving that there and expecting that everybody would believe it, because I don't think anybody does. Everybody wants good news, but I'm not sure anybody believes it anymore, because it's almost just a clickbait story that is read and consumed and then completely disregarded within seconds. And, you know, we're just not getting anywhere.
No, exactly. I think the industry deserves more in terms of clarity.
Absolutely. So on that point, Hannah, that brings us to the end of our review of the first three quarters of 2021. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. And don't forget to send us your thoughts and comments on what we discussed or what we missed out or what you disagree with. Drop us an email at hello@seasiatravelshow.com or message us on our LinkedIn page at the Southeast Asia Travel Show or on Twitter at SEA Travel Show.
Meanwhile, you can catch up with the Southeast Asia Travel Show's full back catalogue on our website, www.theseasiatravelshow.com, or on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, Pocket Cast, Podchaser, Castbox, Podcast Addict, Overcast, and Stitcher. Just search for the Southeast Asia Travel Show on each app. And don't forget, if you listen to us on Apple Podcasts, please give us a review. That helps other people find the show.
It certainly does. So that's a wrap for this week. But actually, we'll be back on Wednesday with Singapore-based aviation expert Maya Patel from OAG as our guest. And we look forward to talking Southeast Asia travel and tourism again with you very soon.